My name is Julio Huato, and this is the third session of the fascinating series of conversations on socialism. In the first one, we talk about the reason why socialism exists. And my proposition was that socialism was a response of people to conditions that exist that don't measure up to their aspirations and their needs. And that it was a response that was radical and it was organic in the sense that it wasn't going to easily go away because it necessarily followed from the conditions that exist and from the fact that you know human beings engage the world in a very characteristic manner that sociologists, economists call labor. Purposeful activity through which we transform our environment and ourselves. And in the second session, I focus on one of those existing conditions that is particularly offensive to human beings, and that is the disparities in wealth, in income, in access to the use or consumption of goods, and we talk about efficiency as well, about the need for an alternative society to be sustainable, to be robust, and how humbling the historical experience of socialism was. Because those problems that pop up and that led to great tragedies in those nations that intended to build socialism are yet to be resolved. But my conjecture is that the need for social change is not going away, that the necessity of transforming society remains, and that there are very good reasons why we should be discontent with the society that exists, and with our social institutions, in our case with capitalism, with the existing state, etc. In this session, I am going to try to present to you a view. This is a particular view. As I said in the first session, the intellectual tradition in which I grew up as a politically active adult requires a view of a society, a view of socialism. That doesn't invoke the word of God. And so it's a secular intellectual tradition, the tradition of Marxism. I don't think, at least that's my interpretation, that it's an anti-religious view. Indeed, Marx made some remarks that were anti-religious, but Marx was not only an atheist or a non-believer, but he was also a revolutionary, a practical revolutionary, and he had a sense of a realistic sense of what could be accomplished, and he never placed the as an adult, as a young man, because of the debates that were raging in the among philosophers. Young philosophers in Germany, and that centered pretty much on religion. He expressed, he studied and made some very harsh judgments on religion, on the religious view of the world. But as an adult, he wasn't particularly interested in combating religion or fighting religion. If we are not allowed to invoke the word of God, invoking the word of God, for example, to explain the need for social change, I think it would make it relatively easy to do so. I mean, you can always say it's God's will expressed in the in the upraising of the masses against the status quo, right? So this is about trying to understand from this secular perspective how society changes, how society evolves. And there are two concepts that I have to introduce. One of them is the concept of social structures, and the other is the concept of historical agency. I think that the terms are suggestive, even for those of you who are not familiar with this type of jargon and this strand in human thought. But just what is a structure? An illustration that I particularly like is one provided by Marvin Minsky, the head of the MIT Laboratory for Artificial Intelligence. He has a theory of mind. He calls it the society of mind, and it's a materialistic explanation of the mind, of human consciousness. And just like there are materialistic explanations of life, biological organisms. The notion is that you have to explain life, for example, right? You have to explain life as the result or the emergent property of interactions among lifeless elements. So lifeless bricks, right, interact with one another in such a way that the emergent property of those lifeless bricks, when they relate to one another, is what we call life. So similarly, explaining the mind requires that we start with elements that in and by themselves are mindless. They are not aware of itself. They don't have any of the grand properties of human consciousness. But when you put them all together and they interact with one another, then what comes out as a result is the mind. So the illustration that Marvin Minsky uses is this. He says, like, have three blocks and just, laid out randomly. That's just three blocks laid out randomly. But now put two of those blocks, lay them out in a certain, relation to each other. And then on top of it, place the other one. And then now you have a bridge, right? Where does the bridgeness of the bridge come from? And the bridgeness of the bridge doesn't come from the three blocks. Is the three blocks, but relating to each other, placed with respect to each other in a certain position. And that's what creates the bridgeness of the bridge, right? The quality of that thing being now a bridge, as opposed to just three objects placed randomly. And so the human race is made up by individuals, but individuals that interact. Right? Aristotle said it, I think, very well when he said that humans are son politikon, right? or a social animal or a political animal, right? An animal that requires a polis, that requires congregation. The most basic functions of human life, reproduction, require the, so far require the participation of at least two human beings. The production of wealth in general requires the participation of many human beings, and human beings have to relate to each other in certain ways. So when humans relate to each other or one another in certain ways, the emergent property of that, which is a sort of second nature, is what we call society, right? We produce society by relating to each other, right? Relating to one another. And there are certain certain interactions that have a certain stability, and that is what usually sociologists or economists or historians call social structures. So that's what I mean by social structure. Now, a social structure typically is something that you look at a certain point in time. Now, social structures have a social content, meaning that there is a social interaction that makes it possible, but they always exist in some physical form. They exist in a physical form. At the very least, they exist in the physical form of the individuals that I engage. Like suppose, you know, a very basic relation, right? A romantic relation between two human beings. Right? Well, that exists, that manifests itself physically. Right? It has physical manifestations. It exists in the brain or nervous system structures of the individuals involved, right? It may exist in the form of, I don't know, like a I love you card or, you know, flowers. So it has a physical existence, right? But the of course, what defines the relationship is the human interaction, which is not something that, which is not something physical or material, right? Which is something social, right? So social structures have a social content, but they have a physical appearance. Now, what is historical agency? Well, historical agency, let me just repeat this idea. Social structures, when you look at them at a point in time, right, you can identify them, right? For example, the social relations that Americans establish with one another, civically or politically, they have the existence of a federal government, right? The federal government is an institution that is emerges and it has a physical presence, right, in the physical existence of the political representatives of the nation, in the buildings, right, that are owned by the federal government, etc. In all these, the institution of the federal government as a whole. So, social structures, we look at them at a point in time. However, social structures obviously change because human interactions evolve. So, how do they change? Well, here it enters this notion of historical agency, which is the action of individuals. The actions that individuals undertake are with respect to one another and with respect to the rest of nature, they transform the social structures. These social structures are transformed. Now, there is a long-lasting debate among social philosophers, political scientists, sociologists, etc., about which aspect social structure or historical agency has preeminence. Among Marxists, actually, Marxists are not a single mind about that. There are some Marxists that emphasize the power of the existing social structures to shape up the behavior of people, and there is a lot in Karl Marx's own writings that would justify such a view, right? That say that, you know, the economic conditions, the level of development of our productive capacities, our technology, etc., that determines, you know, the sort of institutions that we have and the kind of social behavior that we observe. That's one strong current within Marxism. There is another one that says, but Marx also wrote that, you know, that history is the history of class struggle. So that means that people, through their fighting, you know, they're fighting for, you know, the to promote their interests, to advance their economic interests or whatever, through that process of fighting, or, you know, for example, in a capitalist society, you know, capitalists, individual capitalists, by competing with one another, right? It's through those actions, through that kind of historical agency, that capitalism transformed itself, right? Or through the class struggle between capitalists and workers, etc. So it's historical agency that should have the prominent place, and social structures are secondary. So there is this debate, and it's a chicken and egg debate. I think that what is required, and that's for those of you who may be interested in looking at some of the sources of this debate among Marxists, right? One of the schools, the one that emphasizes the social structures, relies on that contribution of the to the critique of political economy, and the other school would rely, for example, the Communist Manifesto or in this other book that he wrote. The first book is about trying to understand how a capitalist society functions. Is a book that he later incorporated into Capital, the major work that Marx wrote. The second book is a book about a historical episode in France, a coup d'etat and political events. And it's interesting that the first one, when he's trying to explain how a capitalist society functions, he emphasizes the role of social structures, the social structures that exist, kind of condition how human beings behave. And however, in this other book, Marx says humans, or well, he didn't say humans, he said men. Men make their own history, he wrote, right? But they don't make their own history, you know, arbitrarily, they do it within certain conditions. But kind of the emphasis is on we people make our own history. So, this is a very daring illustration that I'm going to use here, and I'm afraid, because I'm really ignorant about this type of stuff, that I may mess it up royally. But I was thinking about an analogy that could help me convey this understanding of this connection between the social structures and you know, the possibilities of, for example, political action. Like, think of Wisconsin, right? You have legislation, right, that is passed, that is imposed, right, and that curtails the right of public employees to bargain collectively with the state government, and you know, that's kind of a hard reality, right, that is being imposed in Wisconsin, that is being created, that's being produced in Wisconsin through the machinery of government. And then, you know, there are a lot of people racing up against that protesting against it and trying to overturn it, right? And so they're taking, that's the historical agency aspect of it. So this is my understanding of this kind of drawing from the Marxist tradition. Using the analogy of a human individual who is, like in my case, always struggling to try to control his weight. Trying to control my weight, like I have a tendency, I have diabetes in my family, etc. So I have to be mindful of those things. And not that I know much about this, but it seems to me that if you look at a human individual, the body of a human individual at any point in time, you're talking about the anatomy, right? The anatomy, the proportion between muscles and fat tissue, etc. And it seems to me that that the fat that I have in my body kind of has a mind of its own. It just wants to be reproduced. So, you know, the kind of things that I can accomplish physiologically, right, not only my digestion, but also my physical performance is heavily conditioned by anatomy, right? When I feel overweight and all that, then I'm slower and, you know, weaker and etc. So physiology seems to be conditioned by anatomy, or anatomy conditions physiology. My metabolism, right, suffers when I feel heavier, and vice versa. Now, my physiology, my metabolism, the rate of, you know, for example, calorie intake versus calorie expenditure seems to condition my lifestyle, the habits that I have in terms of diet and activity and things like that. And then my lifestyle conditions my moods, right, my momentary thoughts and my emotional state. So let's call that psychology. So it would go like that, right? Anatomy kind of puts boundaries to the, you know, to the wiggle. It narrows the wiggle room, of my metabolism and my physiology. My physiology also narrows the wiggle room of my lifestyle. My lifestyle also puts barriers to my psychology. However, this is the bad news, right? However, if I can succeed, and you know, I confess it's very hard, but you know, if I can succeed at controlling my momentary psychological states and say like, okay, enough food, you know, I had enough, you know, that kind of thing, then the psychological changes, if sustained, can become a habit, can turn into a lifestyle, into something more permanent. Changes in lifestyle, if sustained, can alter my physiology. And then physiological changes, if I manage to sustain them, can alter my anatomy. I have experienced that, so I think that it's indeed possible. I think that this is not a terribly bad analogy when thinking about societies. The hypothesis that Marxists present is that the production possibilities of a society put conditions, impose conditions on the type of economic institutions that we can build. Like, for example, the type of effective ownership, right, over productive wealth. Not legal ownership, right? Not legal ownership, but effective ownership. In one of the sessions, in some of the discussions, we were talking about the experience of the Soviet Union, and I was relating to the audience that, you know, after the end of, during, as a result of the civil war in Russia under the Bolsheviks, the Bolsheviks took the measure of nationalizing a bunch of companies that they weren't really able to manage. They appropriated them legally, but they didn't even have the power to enforce their legal ownership. So in fact, you know, it was just in paper, but it wasn't really effective in practice. So that, you know, legal ownership is cheap. It's like words are cheap, right? You can, you know, you are the government, you can issue an order, you can, you know, a presidential, you are the president, you can issue a presidential order, right? But, you know, we know that presidents cannot issue arbitrary presidential orders because probably they wouldn't last, right? Similarly, Congresses cannot pass any kind of law because they also may get in trouble, etc. So production possibilities condition economic institutions condition legal institutions. The legal framework of a society seems to be very heavily dependent on the type of economic institution. By economic institutions here, I'm really referring to plain cost and benefit. You know, what is the cost and what is the benefit of this kind of an institution, right? Not something effective, not something just desired or you know, decreed by the government. Legal institutions condition the political configuration, and the political configuration of society conditions the ideology. But then we have this, right? Shifts in ideology. Right? This is something, for example, in the recent history of the United States. I think it's very... I recently read this book by Paul Krugman on how the conservative movement over, you know, a few decades managed to shift the ideological center of gravity of the country towards the right, right? Towards the notion of, you know, free markets and the government shrinking to a very small size. And then as a result of that change in ideology, it is possible for certain political forces to emerge and to establish themselves, be more assertive in the political arena. And then as a result of that change in the political landscape through the country, it is possible also to alter the legal framework so that you are consolidating those gains, and even if, you know, so that it's going to be very difficult for society to change in the other direction, right? You are creating conditions, you are like fait accompli, right? You are creating de facto situations that are going to be very hard to reverse. And then alterations in the legal framework, if they are sustained, they alter economic and overall social structures are going to be changed as a result. And then changes in economic structures, if they are sustained, They can expand, or also they can actually diminish our productive powers. I believe that the kind of changes that were introduced in the United States, political changes that were, legal changes that were introduced in the United States in the last 20 years, are probably going to harm the productive powers of this nation for a few decades to come. Right? This gridlock that we are seeing with the, you know, for example, the inability of the federal government to implement fiscal policy to try to reduce unemployment, right? Which is a very tragic situation, that you have children here, that you have teachers here, right? And in my conversations with people here in Holden Village, I've been saying, like, it's like, you know, there is a bunch of wood logs on the road there, and there are people there with axes with those machines to cut them off, and we need wood for the winter, but the state has no money. Holding has no money, so that means that the logs are going to be there, and the people who have the access are going to be there. Teachers are going to be here. The children without teachers are going to be here. So that situation, when you look at things broadly, doesn't make sense. Right? It doesn't make sense that the country is experiencing these high levels of unemployment, about 10% of the labor force being jobless. That is a great loss of productive power for the nation that has lasting effects, because when people stay unemployed for a long period of time, their skills decay and they become obsolete, etc. And then, you know, buildings decay, everything decays if it's not used productively. So that is basically the speech that I had prepared for today, and I would like to hear your opinions about it, and your comments. This is not specifically socialism as we have discussed it in the previous session, but I thought that this was of interest. Mm-hmm. Yes, please.
Do you think that socialism would work well with capitalism, and we could use both coherent at the same time? Or do you think, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts are that how can I put this? People who are discontent, for example, with a capitalist society, right? Let me backtrack a little bit. These terms, capitalism and socialism, are very abstract terms, right? And I use them, right? And we all use them in our conversations. But when we, capitalism, at least the way I understand it, right, is a set of economic structures that are characterized by two conditions. Number one, that markets are generalized. That means that the bulk of the production of wealth is not produced directly to meet human needs, but it's produced immediately for trade, for the market. And then through that mediation, it goes to the consumers, to the people who will use that wealth. But immediately the wealth is produced for the market, for trade. Not only for trade, it is produced for profit. So it not only has to be commercialized in the market, but it also has to be profitable. So that's one thing. And the other is that markets are so generalized, the other condition is that social inequality is such, right, that there is a lot of people, a majority of a society, that the only way those people can sustain their lives is by selling their ability to work. That means that over their entire lifetime, right, they depend mostly from the income that they generate through their selling their labor power. It is true that, for example, American and European workers save some of their wages and salaries. For example, they put them in pension plans and then they draw from them in the future. But those people are workers. Those people are workers who, you know, but when I refer to a capitalist, I'm referring to somebody who doesn't have to work for most of his or her lifetime. That would be a capitalist. So those conditions are abstract conditions. In the real world, you have much more complicated situations. Like, for example, in the United States, there are certain there are certain areas where wealth is produced, right? Where wealth is produced, but it is not produced in a capitalist way. For example, you know, when we take care of our children at home, we are producing wealth, right? Because we are taking care. It's a real service that enhances our welfare. It has real benefits. And see, however, we are not doing that for sale, and we are not doing that for profit, right? Public education, right? New York City, for example, you know, with support from the state and from the federal government, provides public education to most children in New York rely on public education, and that is not for profit. And well, it's kind of shifting, right, because of the charter school movement. But this is still, for the most part, a publicly provided service, etc. So it's a more complicated picture. So now, when people massively, right, rebel against a given society, they don't do it with the abstract thought of, oh, we are going to build socialism. In no case that I know in history. For example, that didn't happen in Russia in 1917. In Russia in 1917, people just wanted to get out of the war, and they just wanted, you know, just the basic conditions for survival. They wanted bread, peasants wanted land, private ownership of land, individual private ownership of land. That's what they wanted. The Bolsheviks promised that, and that's why they supported the Bolshevik Revolution. So it wasn't, let's build socialism. The let's build socialism came afterwards, and it was mostly an idea that the leaders of that revolution had, that it percolated a little bit to the masses of people, but the masses of people were concerned with other with their lives, with their livelihoods. So I think that When you ask me, you know, is it possible to combine, you know, this aspect of capitalism with this aspect of socialism? Indeed, that happened not so much because we deliberately pursue that, but because, you know, things cannot be changed, all of them, at the same time overnight. So in the historical experiences of socialism, for example, in the case of Cuba, right? That is the way it happened. The revolution, rebellion against Batista, succeeded in January of 1959. And then, you know, the leaders of the revolution didn't have a very clear idea about what to do next, except for a few steps. Agrarian reform, land reform, the redistribution of land to peasants. Then the nationalization of some companies, foreign companies, and then some large local companies, things like that, solving like problems of working people. And then, as a result of the hostility of the United States, they shifted. They had to nationalize massively. In 1961, they passed a law that nationalized, like even like the coffee's kiosk at the corner. Right, and the government didn't have the resources to really manage all that. It was doing it because it wanted to remove the financing, the funding for the counter-revolution. So it was like in reaction to those things that so and certain things were managed just the way they were managed before, as you know, private capitalist enterprises, because the government couldn't really effectively socialize those properties. So like there were cooperatives, there were private peasants that were hiring labor. Then the hiring of labor became illegal, but they did it, but under, etc. So like in actual historical situations, all those combinations and permutations will be observed. I don't know if that answers the question. It's very bold answer, but yes.
Maybe you could help me. It's always been my thought that socialism meant that property was going to be owned in general by society, or that and of course we're not there, and I'm not sure we want to be there.
Right.
So when we're talking about socialism here tonight, and where we have it or don't have it, or where we're going, could you define what you mean by socialism in the context of what we're talking about here? Are you talking about something other than ownership?
Let me see if I can answer that directly. In contrast with capitalism, right? I would envision a society where the productive wealth of society, by the productive wealth of society, I don't mean toothpaste and toothbrushes, right?
Yeah.
Or oranges, or, you know, oranges to produce orange juice, yes. Oranges to produce, I mean, Tropicana, or, you know, I don't know what the producers of orange juice on this side of the nation are, but those companies would, or those facilities would be socially or collectively managed under socialism. Consumption goods, consumptive wealth, wealth that is going to be used immediately by people for their personal enjoyment, that is, of course, that goes as personal property of people. Now, why is that required? The argument of Marxists is because you don't want the mediation of the market. You don't want to help other people you don't want to help other people as a means to helping yourself only. In other words, you don't want to turn others into an instrument to your ends. But you have to interact with other people as human beings. You have to look at the other person in terms of their needs, in terms of not only as a means to your ends, but as an end in itself. And then in that requires the elimination of those mediations. Those mediations include not only the market, but also political mediations. That means that when people interact civically with one another, they don't need the interaction through a political apparatus, a hierarchical apparatus where some people have political power and other people are just citizens. This is hard to envision, but it's by contrast with the existing society. So the way you imagine, the way you visualize socialism is by turning upside down the existing society.
So then the question I have is that how do you pay for that? Because I assume that you've got a whole new sector that is not going to be taxed, and how do you afford it? I guess that may be a dumb question.
No, it's not. Well, if the productive wealth is earned collectively, then the fruits of are collectively appropriated. So we call it taxation, and it appears as a forceful appropriation of our private wealth by a political apparatus that appears to be detached from us. I was saying in the first session that what, according to Marxists, characterizes the existing conditions is this phenomenon that they call alienation, or that Marxists call alienation. And alienation means that something that you create, something that you produce, escapes your control and turns against you and oppresses you. That happens with markets, right? And the phenomena of markets, the prices move in every which way, and we don't have farmers don't control the price of corn, right? And when the price of corn crashes down, you know, they experience tremendous suffering as a result of that, and it appears almost like a natural phenomenon. Well, similarly with the government or with the institutions of the state, it's a mediation in our human interactions. It's not a direct relationship among humans. Because, for example, I cannot enter Canada without a visa. So I need the political apparatus to grant me a visa for me to be able to, you know, cross that border. So that's another case of alienation. That's a phenomenon that has that we have produced. We human beings have produced that political apparatus, but that political apparatus is not controlled by me individually. It actually oppresses me and curtails my freedoms. And so socialism is conceived as a society that produces and expands freedom, the powers of individuals. And not only in the sense of that we have more power to transform nature, but also in the sense that we are less on each other's, on one another's ways. We are not obstacles to the actions or aspirations of one another. So now, when you say, you know, how do we pay for all this? Well, you know, think of Holden Village. You know, how do we afford, you know, the food that we, we collectively contribute one way or another, be it with money or be it with labor, right? And then, you know, we distribute the fruits our the contributions as we pull them, we distribute them according to need, basically. If you now, if you are hungry, you can go to the cafeteria, the dining hall, and have a bread or, you know, cereal or something, right?
Well, would that mean then that if you had, would that mean that the to the extent that we were earning wages or whatever you want to call it for our own individual needs, necessarily our tax support, the government would go up? In other words, would that happen?
Okay. There are in the Marxist vision of socialism, right? Socialism wouldn't pop up all of a sudden. It would be the result of a very prolonged process. So there would be intermediate steps, and those intermediate steps would be different in different societies, because each society would have to be faithful to its own history. So in some cases, for example, Karl Marx said in referring to the case of Germany, he said, in a first stage of, you know, the development of socialism, we may need to have to pay workers in accordance to their contribution. Right? In other words, we are not going to pay them in accordance to their need. So that would be equal rights among unequal individuals. So that situation is unfair. Why? Because if you contribute the same as your neighbor, but you have more children, that you have more needs than your neighbor, right? You're going to be paid the same. So the situation, we are applying the same rule to individuals who are different. So that situation is unfair. So in a more advanced society, even that rule would be overthrown, and you would have the case of which Marx called full communism, where people would contribute to society according to the capacities of that individual, and then out of the pooled productive wealth would be given to people according to need. Of course, for something like that to happen, you would require individuals that are already conformed to that selfless, behavior. Right, they will have to, but the idea is that both the individuals and the society are going to be transformed. That people, as they transform their society, they transform themselves, and they become more mindful. Yes,
when we talk about communism now, aren't you presenting an idealistic point of view of how it would work in perfection? But what really happens with communism? That doesn't happen with communism. They lose their propaganda, comes, they lose their rights. So you're talking about idealistic. What really happens with communism then? In what it really, like capitalism would work very, very well if everyone had the same skills and abilities and everybody could produce and everybody could all make money at the same enough money for their individual needs. But in theory, there are people that can't quite do that. And so so redistribution of wealth is necessary. We've got too many people, too many rich people making way too much money for one person, like all these CEOs, and then they get greedier and greedier. Capitalism would work if there wasn't greed involved. There's too much greed involved for capitalism to work. It'd be ideal if it were distributed and worked well. But what do you mean? So can you address that?
Okay, well, what this story says is that greed is not necessarily an aspect of human nature, but that it's something that is conditioned by the type of economy that we have. We have a society that fosters selfishness and greed, right? Because we are competing with one another. The competition is forced upon. That's what alienation means. It's something that you individually cannot dissolve. You cannot dispel it just because you change your mind and say, you know, here in Holden, there is very little of a money economy, right? We don't use much money here in Holden, right? You need a book, you need to read a book, just go to the library, right? You need food, go to the cafeteria and serve yourself, right?
Well, need to sleep. The money exchange happened long before we came here. Happens the very day you get here, you have to...
That's right, because Holden is connected to the rest of the economy, right?
Right.
And we need to acquire certain things from the rest of the economy. But you see what I mean, right? I mean, like right now here, regardless of how much money you pay, you know, to come here to Holden, right? If you have a kid and you want to bring it to Narnia, you are not going to be charged additionally, right?
But you won't be charged to bring that kid there because you'd probably have to buy another room for that kid or something like that. You'd have to buy a temporary. I don't know how you say this. You would have to rent a.
Yeah, I'm not saying that a socialist society would defy the law of gravity, right? I mean, obviously, right? A society cannot consume more than it can produce, right? What I'm saying is that it is possible to expand the degrees of freedom in how you shape up the distribution of what you produce, right? And of course, that depends on how much you produce. It depends on how much you produce. If you produce more, if you have a larger park, more people can use it, right? Yes.
The thing that really blows your mind is when, you know, these companies in our country, they're sending all their work out to China or to India, and so everybody here loses their jobs. So how can you make them be socialists? You know, have socialists.
Well,
what I'm saying is, if we apply this socialism in our country, I don't think it's going to really make any difference. I don't know. Maybe I don't understand.
Yeah, please.
Well, the trouble is it seems like, as our other teacher here, Ms. Petter, says, it seems like you can't really have a perfect any kind of system. There are always going to be problems. It seems to me that, I mean, I consider myself actually a socialist too, but I've come to the conclusion that certain elements of capitalism are going to exist for a long time, and that what might be an appropriate way of dealing with the problem is simply to change the law that governs how corporations are chartered, requiring them to be one half owned by the worker, requiring decision making to be one half coming from people who work there, one half from stockholders, limit the number of votes, limiting the number of stocks somebody can accrue, limiting the number of votes they can accrue as stockholders, and Both, and plus, I mean, I want people to be able to, there are all kinds of issues such as people, hostile takeovers and that kind of thing that exist. Basically, plus a reasonable welfare state, like, you know, Sweden has a kind of system like that, even when they're not semi-socialist parties like social democrats and power, the welfare state in Sweden may change a little bit, but it doesn't go away. It's not like in this country where everything gets cut suddenly.
Please, Steve.
That too, I think, the system is not set in stone. I mean, our society is not there. We put it up on a shelf. It's constantly changing and evolving, which is your point, is agency is now at work. We say, we don't like these corporations, we don't like government and what it's doing, but we're not innocent bystanders. We vote, and for corporations, we vote with our dollars. We say yes to those companies that are sending them in business upon them. I know how the system is slanted so that the rich do get richer, but you know, we're consumers and we spend a lot of dollars. And if we spend those dollars with a little more thought in it as to who it's benefiting, then we change things where it really hurts, the bottom line.
The problem is, though, that you know, you have to get the corporations behind you if you're going to run for political office. I mean, maybe someone will have smart ideas, just a normal citizen, but how are they going to get recognized? They have to be supported by political lobbyists. And these corporations, they have to support their ideas to take their money. So the only people that are going to be in power are those supported by large corporations, unless you're independently wealthy or famous or something.
We know what keeps happening to Dennis Kucinich. I mean, he's not a socialist, but he's kind of on the way there. And even that is considered too much for some people. He's not even allowed, he's basically getting his kind of the congressional district he's represented for years is basically being cut out from under him. And people are basically, even other liberals are basically hands off him. And why is that? Because to some extent, maybe he's a little bit nutty in some areas, but he's also, but I also think that to some extent it's because of manipulation by the corporate system and the lobbyists and all that kind of thing.
Yes, please.
Some of us are of an age where we're on Social Security and we have Medicare, and we have
socialism.
That's what I'm saying. So some of us are being enriched by socialism, and those who are not on Medicare and are a little bit younger, they can say that we paid for our retirement or Social Security way back then, but we didn't. The younger folks are paying our bills right now. And the thought to me is, well, what happens if you lower the retirement or Social Security age from 67 or where it is now to 47? Now we got a really socialist system, because and what's going to happen then is that then we are going to have to find another way of paying for that. And while socialism is attractive in some ways, you still got to pay the bills. And a lot of us don't have enough money to have all of a sudden our taxes go up.
Actually, it'd be simple tweaking. I don't think it would take that much to turn everything around. For instance, this tax on people that make $1 million or $2 million or whatever that Bill Gates was supporting, if they would give some of that to the system, it'd tweak everything around. You'd be surprised. It really wouldn't take a whole lot to tweak the whole thing around. I can't really explain it because I'm not knowledgeable enough, but I know that it wouldn't take a lot to fix things up, to change everything. I mean, look at Stalin we're doing, or what?
Let's back there.
I just want to say, sort of response to kind of what you were saying, that there are places you can go online and you can see the entire national budget, and then you can go around and tweak with it, basically sort of online spreadsheets. And you can see it actually really takes, you're right, very little. Like, we only have to go back to like taxes, say like 10 years ago. Well, of course, yes, taxes 10, maybe 12 years ago now.
To solve the social security.
And you really solve the whole Medicare, Medicaid, social debt problem.
I guess my position is that we should be willing. We're doing fine now. We're not wealthy, and I was a sole practitioner, so I didn't have a pension plan, and so I had to, we're kind of living off the stuff that I could save, but we're doing fine. You know, our house is paid for, we haven't lived, and I think that we could actually end up, it wouldn't kill us if somehow that we had to pay a little bit more in, but to talk that right now is blasphemy. I mean, and then those that do have $1 million, that they would never hear of it. So I think we could start solving it, but I think we have to start being willing to be a part of the solution and not just others to get there, because otherwise I think we're just going to keep chasing the issue down the...
Well, there's been a lot of good proposals in healthcare. I mean, and they've just been stalled and trapped, and so many good changes that we're trying to make, but we get stalled, and then they turn around and say, well, you're not doing anything while they're blocking the process. I mean, we could get a lot more done, but then Obama gets blamed. He said, well, you're not doing anything. Why are you doing anything? You haven't done a darn thing. Well, they're stalling him, and then they turn around and blame him. Well, obviously I'm a Democrat, but...
You know, in the previous sessions, we were talking about this issue of human nature versus, you know, what is socially conditioned and all that. It just comes to my mind, and it is important to distinguish what is really material to our life as a society, something that we cannot abolish, something that we cannot live without, versus, you know, those aspects of our social life that we can conform in a more intentional manner, right? That we can design. But I think that we tend to believe that what we observe is indispensable for us as a society. Like, for example, you know, this something that I find fascinating, actually, is how this issue of the public debt of the federal government, right, is used ideologically. In my mind, and I, you know, I got a PhD in finance economics, so I have thought a little bit about this thing, and in my mind, this issue of the public debt is really simple. What debt means is that somebody owes something to somebody, right? That means that, you know, it's a bond, it's a relation. It's like, you know, I owe you something that I will repay to you, right? Like, suppose that I am a farmer and I produce wheat. And suppose that you are a miller and you grind the wheat, right? So, I can do this, you know, like I want to keep producing a lot of wheat and sell it to you, right? But you cannot buy it cash. So what you say is like, why don't you, you know, allow me to buy it on credit? It's like, sure, you know. And they just sign these IOUs. And you're going to hand me those IOUs, right? I know you are a hardworking person, and you're going to keep your business going, and I'm going to be producing my wheat, and I'm going to be selling it to you on credit. When you have the cash, you pay me, and we keep that relationship going, and it's continuity, and it's great, happy times. Now, suppose that something happens to you, and you know, you cannot repay your debt to me, right? Then I can say, forget it. I'm not selling you wheat anymore. I just want my money back, you know? And etc. I will take you to court, etc. Then now, you know, I don't have you as a client. I'm not going to be able to sell you my wheat, right? So a different approach would be this: would be, you know, I know you're a hardworking person. Right? I know that, you know, that, and I benefit from selling the wheat to you because, you know, I want to keep doing that. So I'm just going to roll over the debt to you. I'm just going to roll it over. And I can do that, and if I withdraw, right, if I say, because when we are trading, we are cooperating, I'm helping you, you are helping me. And when we stop trading, then we stop cooperating. We withdraw, and then that's it, but I'm hurting myself, because I don't have to whom sell my wheat, right? So, well, back to the story of the public debt of the United States of America, right? So the United States of America, that means us as a society, owe money to whoever is holding the those treasuries, right? Those treasury bills, treasury bonds, whatever. Okay, well, it turns out that at least in the, since 2007, when the financial meltdown happened, up to now, most of the debt that has been issued and sold by the Treasury has been sold to Americans. Americans who switch in their portfolios to bonds, to treasuries. That's why the interest rate that the federal government pays now, it's so low. Right? I mean, not only short term, which the Fed pretty much controls. I'm talking about the longer term debt of the United States, which is relatively low. And it hasn't been China, by the way, although many people think that has been. The Chinese have continued to purchase treasuries, but most, the bulk of the treasuries have been sold by the U.S. In the last few years has been to Americans. So that means that we Americans owe money to Americans. Right? So how did FDR manage this? Well, you know, forget the New Deal, the Second World War. Right? It was the Second World War, and then people had jobs because we had to win the war, right? Because Americans had to win the war. So people went to work, etc. Public debt, private debt, household debt went up. Right? Of course, the debt of the United States went up. As a percentage of GDP, debt after the end of World War II in 1945 was greater than today. Greater than today. And yet, right, after the Second World War, just with the exception of the, you know, the Korean War, the little recession, there were like easily, 30 years of prosperity in the United States. And what happened to the public debt and what happened to the private debt? It disappeared from the radar, right? Yeah. Well, so what happened? Well, there was inflation, right? Inflation is not good for everybody, but it's good for whoever owes money to others. In this case, the federal government and private households that owe money mostly to the rich. So that means that the rich lost. There was an effective redistribution of wealth in the United States under FDR. And it was not through the New Deal, mostly. It was mostly through inflation. Basically, you are taking money from the rich and giving it to the poor. Because when you know, if you are paying a mortgage on a fixed rate, right, you end up paying much less, right, in actual purchasing power, in terms of actual wealth. You're paying the same amount of money, but it's less in terms of pizzas and oranges and computers. So the problem of the public debt is that the rich in the United States, the Chinese as well, etc., whoever is the creditor of the United States, right, is not going to like inflation. But inflation could be a solution. It wouldn't be painless, yeah, right, but it could be a solution. The other solution is, of course, you know, increasing taxes. Increasing taxes. And the other is, you know, persuading their, good luck with that, with this, right? Yeah. But it would be persuading those who hold treasuries, those who are credited, who have lent money to the United States, to forgive that debt, to just take those treasuries and destroy them. You know, just like civically minded Americans who are very rich and who have treasuries in their portfolios, they can say, okay, no problem, I'm destroying them. That would be the solution. Of course, I'm not talking about widows and, you know, like, you know, workers who have, you know, treasures in their pension plans.
People like me who have a small amount of, who have maybe about $11,000 worth of them.
You would be one of those who would be on the other side, right? Benefiting from this from this move.
Well, you see, the thing is I wouldn't want, is they're for retirement, so.
Say again?
They're for my retirement. They're not for so I can get richer.
There you go. So that wouldn't apply to you. But believe me, there is a very small percentage of Americans who have a lot of treasuries in their portfolios, and who in some cases were born to wealth.
But they're going to say Jesse Klingman isn't tearing his treasury bills up, why should we? And a lot of people don't believe in seeing themselves. A lot of people simply don't want to see themselves as.
Because if you don't do that, something bad could happen. Like a revolution or something.
But you know, very rich people have, many of them, some of them, not all of them, of course, you can't generalize. Right. They've stepped on a lot of toes and pushed a lot of people around. And I don't understand why, when a corporation makes more money, they decrease salaries and lay people off as they're making more money. I just don't understand how they get away with stepping on so many toes. I know somebody who did that in the bank system. I don't know him, but I mean, it's sort of involved. They just did a lot of dirty things to get where they are. And then they get away with it because they've gotten so powerful and so rich that nobody cares. They just let it be.
Yeah, well, Balzac and the... please. Balzac wrote that behind every great fortune there is a great crime. Yeah, I think we are past the time. Thank you very much. It was a little bit disorganized, the answer to your questions, but the actual conversation among you was pretty good, so thank you.
Actually, a good example of corporations aren't the corporations.
I didn't expect those questions about socialism, right?